Chairman Fallon, and his left is Commissioner LaVar. We appreciate your attendance today. We're here in the matter of Rocky Mountain Power's proposed revisions to electric service schedule number 37, avoided cost purchases from qualifying facilities. This is Public Service Commission docket number 14-035-T04. Let's begin this morning with appearances of counsel. And if you'd introduce the witness or witnesses that you have present today, that would be appreciated as well.
Thank you, Commissioner Clark, Chairman Allen, Commissioner LaVar. My name is Daniel Solander. I'm representing Rocky Mountain Power. I have with me at council table Greg Duvall, Director of Net Power Costs for Rocky Mountain Power.
Thank you.
I'm Justin Jenner with the Utah Attorney General's Office, representing the Utah Division of Public Utilities. And with me at the council table here is Dr. Abdunasser Abdullah for the division. Thank you.
My name is Rex Olson. I'm here on behalf of the Office of Consumer Services in Philip Aspen, being analyst with the office is here to move this.
Thank you. Is that OLSEN or OLEN?
Ian.
Thank you.
Good morning, Commissioners. I'm Sophie Hayes, representing Utah Clean Energy. And with me as Utah Clean Energy's witness is Ms. Sarah Wright.
Good morning. I'm Gary Dodge here on behalf of SunEdison. My witness, Daniel Patry, was unable to make it. He has an 8-month-old in the hospital and was unable to make it. So we're going to request, or we are requesting, that we submit his pre-file testimony as unsworn comment, as opposed to testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Dodge.
Good morning, I'm William Evans here for Kennecott Utah Copper and Tesoro Refining and Marketing. We too have filed comments in this proceeding, but don't have a witness. And incidentally, don't have cross for witnesses, so I will ask that once the preliminaries have been done, if I may be excused from the rest of this proceeding.
Thank you, Mr. Evans. Are there any preliminary matters that council desires to raise before we begin? Our approach today will be to hear first from the applicant of the company, and then we'll take the witnesses in the order that the appearances of council were made, unless there's objection to that process. And if there's nothing further, we'll begin. Mr. Solander.
Thank you. Rocky Mountain Power, I would like to call Mr. Greg Duvall as its witness in support of the proposed changes to Utah Schedule 37. Mr. Duvall will explain the changes that the company is proposing that were made as a result of the commission's order in docket 12-035-100.
Please raise your right hand. Do you solemnly swear that the testimony you're about to give should be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
Thank you. Please be seated.
Morning. Good morning.
Could you please state and spell your name for the record?
Yeah, my name is Gregory N. Duvall, D-U-V-A-L-L.
And what is your current position for Pacific Fork Rocky Mountain Power?
I'm the Director of Net Power Costs.
And did you oversee the filing of proposed tariff changes, as well as filing direct and rebuttal testimony in this proceeding?
Yes, I did.
Do you have any changes or corrections to any of your testimony?
Yes, I have one change to my direct testimony on page 17. And that's on line 361. Where I say that it will not reach its peak until between 3 p.m. and 4 p.m. It should be 4 p.m. and 6 p.m. Mountain Daylight Time. I was confused on Pacific time when I wrote this testimony.
Okay. With that exception, if I were to ask you all of the questions that are contained in your direct and rebuttal testimony, your answers would be the same?
Yes, it would.
And have you prepared a summary of your testimony today?
Yes, I have.
Please proceed with that.
Okay. So my direct testimony provides support for the company's May 7th, 2014 filing to update Schedule 37 prices. The company made these changes largely as a result of the commission's order in the renewable QF docket 12035100. If the company's changes are adopted, there are two primary remaining differences between Schedule 37 and 38. Schedule 37 uses a proxy method, while Schedule 38 uses a partial displacement differential revenue requirement method, or the PDDRR. And Schedule 37 is a tariff that applies to all QFs that qualify for Schedule 37, while Schedule 38 is project allocation specific. These two differences allow Schedule 37 to remain simple to understand. The company proposes five notable changes to Schedule 37 to align with the commission's order in the renewable QF docket. First, integration costs were added for wind and solar. Second, the capacity contribution was added for solar. The capacity contribution was already included for wind, and that was updated to conform with the latest commission findings. Third, capacity costs based on a simple cycle combustion turbine were removed from the sufficiency period and retained in the deficiency period. Fourth, the assumed carbon tax was removed from the forward price curve. And fifth, the pricing option that provides for a fixed capacity payment plus a flat energy payment was eliminated. All parties supported inclusion of the capacity contribution for specific types of resources. Utah Clean Energy took exception to the remaining four other changes. My rebuttal testimony addresses the issues raised by Utah Clean Energy and later supported by SunEdison. The addition of integration cost and capacity contribution, removal of the capacity cost in the deficiency period, in the sufficiency period, and removal of the carbon tax assumption were direct results of the commission's order in the renewable QF docket. With regard to integration costs, the company is required to manage the variations of intermittent resources regardless of size or delivery voltage. With regard to size, the company currently has approximately 45 megawatts of Schedule 37 contracts with solar projects in Utah, which in aggregate is consistent in size with a Schedule 38 QF. In addition, UCE's proposal is not practical as it would result in a 3 megawatt QF not paying for integration costs, but a 3.1 megawatt QF would. With regard to delivery voltage, there's no reason to believe that there's a difference in integration costs, integration requirements between transmission and distribution voltage levels. The company currently needs to integrate load, which is primarily at a distribution level. Intermittent resources at distribution level would require integration, just as intermittent resource levels at a resources at a transmission level would. With regard to the capacity payment and the sufficiency period, the company cannot avoid a simple cycle combustion turbine in the sufficiency period. The issue was fully litigated in the renewable QF docket. The same reasons supporting the removal of these costs from Schedule 38 apply to Schedule 37. With regard to the removal of the carbon tax from the forward price curve, it's my understanding the Commission has not approved the inclusion of an estimate of the cost of complying with future carbon legislation in the avoided cost calculation. At this time, the carbon tax assumption used in the IRP are just estimates and do not reflect costs the company can avoid. Until carbon costs can be better defined, an estimate of carbon costs should not be used in the avoided cost calculation. And then with regard to elimination of the capacity and energy payment options, removal of the capacity and energy payment option is necessary so there's only one avoided cost under Schedule 37 that properly reflects avoided costs for all qualifying facility resources. source technologies and does not create an opportunity for QS to game the methodology to extract higher profits at customer expense. The company chose to eliminate the capacity and energy payment option to keep customers from overpaying QS for capacity that is not avoided. The problem with the capacity and energy payment option is the capacity payment is based on the highest 15-minute period within each month, regardless of whether that 15-minute period aligns with the company's capacity needs. UCE agrees that the capacity payment should be reduced by the capacity contribution, but fails to change the measurement period of 15 minutes. They continue to support measuring the capacity contribution based on the 15 minutes. The volumetric pricing structure in the company's proposal is calculated in the same manner as the currently approved volumetric pricing. In conclusion, overall, UCE and SunEdison, its position is to continue the status quo. This is unacceptable and is inconsistent with the commission's finding in the renewable QF docket. Their proposal harms customers by artificially inflating avoided costs over those costs the company can actually avoid. That concludes my summary.
Thank you. At this time, we move that Mr. Ball's direct rebuttal testimony be entered into the record, and Mr. Ball is available for cross-examination of the parties or questions from the commission.
Any objection to the evidence being received? The testimony is received. Cross-examination for Mr. Duvall.
I just a brief question for Mr. Duvall. Good morning.
Good morning.
A number of times in your opening statement, you referred to the renewable QF docket. Just to clarify for the record, are you referring to the docket number 12035100?
Yes, I am.
Thank you. That's the only question I have.
Thank you.
Mr. Olson.
No questions.
Yes, Ms. Hayes.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Duvall.
Good morning, Ms. Hayes.
I just have a few questions. Are you aware that most, if not all, of the Schedule 37 solar QFs interconnect to the company's distribution system?
I'm not aware of the interconnection voltage level, no.
All right. Did you take into consideration distribution system benefits associated with solar QFs connected to the distribution system in your calculation of Schedule 37 avoided costs?
So in terms of distribution system benefits, I'm not sure what is being referred to.
Benefits at reducing peak demand on different distribution substations or deferring needed investments in the distribution infrastructure?
No, I did not. At this point, I'm not aware of any savings that could be that could come from those facilities.
So you're not aware that the company has studied distribution benefits such as the ones I just described associated with 2 megawatt PV projects interconnected at the distribution level?
No, I'm not.
All right. Let's see, I want to move to your rebuttal testimony at lines 110 through 112 regarding carbon costs as used in the IRP.
Correct, yep, I'm there.
Okay. You say, because the IRP risk assessment is only an estimate of potential future costs imposed as a direct cost on emissions, it should not be included in avoided cost calculations, correct?
That's correct.
QF's contract with the utility for periods up to 20 years, is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct.
And you use projections of fuel prices and market prices and other assumptions in calculating avoided costs, correct?
That's correct.
And the IRP utilizes price projections and assumptions about the future, such as gas prices, market prices, load forecasts, capital costs, heat rates, O&M costs, etc. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And does the company rely on projected environmental regulation compliance costs and carbon price assumptions in justifying its investments in pollution control technologies?
I believe it does, because it uses the IRP models, which include those assumptions.
Thank you. I have no further questions.
Mr. Dodge.
Thank you. I do just have a couple of questions. When Mr. Duvall, you referenced the 3.1 megawatt Schedule 38 facility and a 3 megawatt 37 facility. How many 3.1 megawatt 38 facilities are you familiar with in your Rocky Mountain territory or in the Pacific territory?
I'm not familiar with any 3.1 megawatt facilities on Schedule 38.
In fact, the reality is 38 facilities are 50 to 80 megawatts almost always, and the 37 facilities are very small, 3 and 90, right?
They're very small, but as I mentioned earlier, we have in aggregate 45 megawatts worth of Schedule 37 customers.
I understand, but I'm responding to your suggestion. It's unfair that a 3.1 megawatt facility on 38 have been treated one way and a 3 megawatt facility treated another. In reality, that's not a fair comparison. That doesn't happen.
It's not happened to date.
Secondly, you suggest equal treatment on the two, other than the two issues that you identified as remaining. But isn't it true that they've been treated differently in all these 7 or 8 ways for all the years we've had a Schedule 37?
I don't know if it's for all the years, but I believe in my direct testimony, I refer back to the original commission order that was a 94 order. And I don't know if that was the beginning of Schedule 37.
And in fact, the commission has repeatedly chosen to treat Schedule 37 differently in many ways in those orders that you reference. Is that not a fair statement?
Well, I think prior to the 12035-100 order, there were capacity costs included for Schedule 38 in the sufficiency period. The commission got rid of those. So I think there were integration costs for wind, which was not something that was in Schedule 37, so that is new. So I'm not aware of any other differences or that Mr. Dodge may be referring to.
You can check, but I think you'll find that in fact 38 has never had, well, never, as many years as I've been watching 38, has never had payments during the sufficiency period. I believe that's specific to Schedule 37. If that's true, that was a deliberate decision to treat capacity payments during the sufficiency period different for 37 than for 38 for many years, if what I represented is true.
Yeah, I'm sorry, my previous answer was incorrect. Mr. Dive is right that there was no capacity in the sufficiency period in Schedule 38. However, as I recall, UCE argued and others argued to add capacity payments in the sufficiency period in that docket, and the commission rejected it.
I think that's a true statement. Yeah. Presumably the commission's had reasons that they've treated the two schedules quite differently over the years. Would you agree with that?
I'm not going to speculate on the commission's reasoning.
Secondly, let me turn quickly to CO2 costs. If you were forced, and I can't force you, but if you were forced to be the spokesman for the company and give this commission your best guess as to the cost of your entire portfolio of resources 10 years or 20 years into the future, do you agree with me it's highly likely that the company spokesperson forced to answer that would include some kind of carbon related costs in the future, whether they be an assumed carbon tax, whether they be regulations under the new EPA regulations for carbon? But they would probably assume some kind of cost is going to be in it. Would you agree with that?
I would suspect that, I mean, the landscape has changed. When the EPA issued their 111D rule in June of this year, it does not have a carbon tax, but it does have other ways of reducing carbon. And I think in the future, future IRPs, we will be looking at the impact of 111D, you know, as it becomes more clear.
Do you suggest that even 111D projected costs not be included in QMA pricing because they're speculative and they're carbon? Is that your position?
With regard to 111D, my position is we don't know what 111D is going to bring yet, but it is a regulation as opposed to just a, you know, assumption. There is a regulation out there that people are working on, states are working on, companies working on, and it's sort of the expectation of the future with regard to carbon at this point.
So once the company makes its best guess in, let's say, in the 2015 IRP context, of what the 111D compliance cost will be, is it the company's position that that best guess as the 111D compliance cost should be included in Schedule 38 and Schedule 37 avoided cost pricing?
Well, I'm not sure. I think, I mean, the difference between 111D and the current IRP assumptions is that 111D is actually a real proposed rule. What's in the IRP now, the carbon cost adders, or the carbon tax adders that are in the IRP right now are, I think, based on previous legislative proposals that have not come to fruition. I think 111D kind of marks a different future because it's actually a real regulation that's been adopted.
My question was, is it the company's position that once the company projects those 111D costs, let me step back. We probably won't know for 5 years or more for sure what 111D is going to cost. Is that a fair assumption because of litigation, expected litigation, regulation process, etc.?
I can't make that assumption.
Assume with me it's going to be many years before the court process is done on 111D and we can project with certainty what those costs are, well, with more certainty what those costs are going to be. Would it be the company's position that until that certainty is there, or more certainty, five or whatever years down the road, that you not include 111D costs in avoided cost pricing?
It's a pretty hard question to answer. I think as we get to a point where we are more comfortable with what 111D will be bringing, you know, that may be a year from now, that may be, you know, 3 years from now, I don't know. There's a lot of work going on in that. I think it'll be a conversation we have in the future in terms of what gets reflected in the company's plans and the company's avoided costs and all that with regard to 111D. I don't have the answers today.
A couple of follow-up. The current IRP does not assume that there will be a carbon tax, does it? It includes a carbon cost based on whether it be cap and trade, a direct carbon tax, or a 111D type regulation. It's an estimate of the cost of the company of complying with expected carbon regulation. Is that not a fair statement?
I always thought it was a tax. It starts at $16 a ton beginning in 2022 and escalates from there.
Have you read the IRP chapter that deals with that, with the why they include a carbon cost as opposed to a carbon tax? Or they use that as a surrogate for expected carbon costs of some sort. Do you disagree with that?
Yeah, I don't disagree with that. I think it's represented in the models as a tax, but I think it is to capture the impacts of carbon in the future from a planning perspective.
So I started by saying if I could force you to be the spokesperson for the company and to give me your best guess as to whether there will be some kind of carbon costs in the company's portfolio 10, 15, 20 years from now. If the answer to that had been yes, were I the company spokesperson, I would guess there will be. And yet, if you set avoided cost pricing today, ignoring any such cost, you're underpaying those customers based on true avoided costs, are you not?
No, I don't believe that estimates are true avoided costs. They're not costs the company can avoid at this point.
Are gas costs in the year 2025 an estimate or a known fact?
Well, they're a forecast provided by a third-party expert group.
And how reliable have they been in the past? You've done some backcasting of that. Have they been really reliable in projecting fuel costs, especially gas costs?
I think that information is in the IRP. I'm not sure how I would characterize it.
Isn't the reality it's been woefully inadequate at predicting and forecasting actual gas prices?
I would not say that. I would say that the forecasts and the actuals don't match, but I would not characterize them as woefully different.
But why is it you choose to pick on carbon projections as opposed to fuel projections to leave out of this pricing for QS?
Well, we know we'll have fuel expenses, and we don't know that we'll have any carbon tax.
And yet the company, for at least a decade or so, has included an assumed carbon cost in its IRP for purposes of justifying wind plants that the company bought, for the purpose of justifying environmental investments in its plants. So the company relies upon an assumed carbon cost in the future to justify its own investments, and yet you're not willing to project that for the purpose of paying people that want to build small QFs. Is that a fair statement?
No, it's not a fair statement.
What part is not fair about that?
The IRP looks at both owned resources and purchased resources. It doesn't really differentiate as to whether the company is going to own it or buy it under a PPA like a QF.
Well, that wasn't the point of my question. It was you did, in fact, build how many hundred megawatts of wind?
I'm sorry, I'm going to object. Mr. Dodge can ask the question without saying what the point of his question is.
Would you just restate the question, Mr. Dodge?
I guess I don't understand the objection. I have to object to the question.
My objection is it's not a question you're asking. You're making a speech and then following up with a question.
This is cross-examination, Mr. Counsel. I'm allowed to do leading questions and to set forth my assumptions in the question.
Mr. Dodge, just rephrase your question or
the question,
restate the question.
I will do so. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The question was, has the company not included an assumed carbon cost in its future cost scenarios or projections for purposes of justifying wind projects that the company built, maybe some that it bought by contract too? That's why I was saying was not the point of the question. But you did build hundreds of megawatts, thousand plus megawatts of wind. You in part relied upon an assumed carbon cost to justify that and to justify fairly massive environmental improvements at your coal plants. Is that not accurate?
Well, I believe there were, we used the IRP framework to justify resources, whether they're company owned or PPAs. But when we get to actually entering a contract with a QF or any or our own facilities or a PPA that's not a QF, we pay actual costs. We don't pay costs that are not actual, that are not avoidable, you know, that don't occur.
So what's the actual cost when you buy wind energy from a wind developer? You sign a PPA. You're paying actual costs?
We are paying the cost that we agreed to in the PPA.
You pay a negotiated cost. And isn't the QF context trying to duplicate that? Because we don't have arm's length negotiations. We're trying to determine what you would pay if you went out and deliberately negotiated for that power purchase agreement at the full cost you would have paid if you'd chosen to do it yourself.
No, I'm not sure I understand the question, but in a PPA with a third party that we acquire through an RFP, whatever they bid in is what they bid in. I don't know what they put in there in terms of their own assumptions about carbon costs in the future.
So what I'm trying to get at is why you're picking on carbon costs alone among all the projections that are just that in a 20-year context. Until this year, you had never proposed the carbon costs were too ambiguous or too uncertain to remove. Your testimony says it's only because you read the commission order suggesting it. Is that a fair statement?
Yes, it is.
So if the commission in that order in the Schedule 38 docket did not intend to say that you must remove your assumed carbon cost that you've used in your IRP for a decade or so, then your proposal to take it out would be not well-founded, unless they choose a different basis for it. Is that a fair statement too?
No, and just, you know, I did look at the order, and I believe that was what the commission said, but as a practical matter, we don't have carbon cost or carbon tax or whatever that we know of that we're going to avoid, and therefore it shouldn't be included in an avoided cost at this time.
Nor do you know what the gas prices are going to be in 10 years, and yet you pay for that.
We know that we're going to burn gas, and it's going to have a cost.
And you can sit here as the company rep and say you don't know you're going to have some kind of carbon costs
well, I'm not the company rep, but I believe I've answered this question already. I think there will be some, I mean, 111D addresses carbon emissions, and there's costs associated with complying with 111D.
So failure to include any assumed carbon cost will, by definition, underpay true avoided cost, the QS, if that cost is, that cost projection is completely ignored. Is that not a fair statement?
No, it's not.
You don't agree with that. Even though you've admitted there will be some costs, and you're proposing not to pay them, you don't see that as not reaching full avoided costs. It's failing to reflect true avoided costs.
Well, I think there's probably more issues with 111D. There may be, we may need to relook at avoided cost when we know more about 111D, due to the fact that there may be some costs that we will need to incur under 111D that may not be appropriate for paying avoided costs under PURPA.
Yeah, I'll go for the questions.
Mr. Evans? No questions, thank you.
Redirect?
No questions, thank you.
Questions from the commission?
I have just a couple of questions for you, or a few questions for you, Mr. Ball. First, in your direct testimony, where you describe the current Schedule 37 methodology, I think it's about lines 96 forward on page 5.
I'm there.
Relative to the prices that are provided in the schedules that were presented with your request for tariff modification, looking first at prices for base load, how is the methodology, if at all, different in, as reflected in those schedules in relation to the current methodology as you describe it here on page 5? In other words, what adjustments have you made that would, if any, that affect those base load price calculations?
So for base load, the integration cost would not apply, the capacity contribution would not apply. Removal of the capacity costs in the sufficiency period would affect that. The removal of the carbon from the official forward price curve would affect it beginning in 2021. And the elimination of the one pricing option would affect it.
And so it's those latter adjustments,
latter three, correct,
that you apply to this, what I'll call the 10 megawatt differential revenue requirements method. Are there any other changes in that method that you've applied in the base load schedule calculation?
Not that come to mind.
And then for the schedules that relate to wind or the two types of solar, the other adjustments would be applied, but again to the same 10 megawatt differential revenue requirement approach that has been used historically.
Yes, the integration costs and the capacity contribution costs.
Thank you. Do you happen to have Ms. Wright's, Sarah Wright's, rebuttal testimony in front of you?
Yes, I do.
Would you turn, please, to page 4? I want to ask you about her testimony at lines 60 through 66. Here she talks about relationship between an 8 cent per kilowatt hour price under Schedule 38, and then, I'm sorry, Schedule 37. Prices under Schedule 38 that she characterizes as having generally been in the 5 to 6 cent per kilowatt hour range. And then prices under the company's proposed method of 3 to 4 cents. Are those correct relationships as you understand them? In other words, is this factually correct?
So the schedules under Schedule 38, or the prices under Schedule 38, which were the 5 to 6 cents, were from Mr. Vasteg's testimony. Mm-hmm. And I think what he's aware of are the prices that have been brought before the contracts that have been brought before the commission for approval. We have given a lot of prices out since then, and while those are project specific, and I don't know if they're confidential or not, but I think I can say that they're in the range of 3 to 4 cents.
And you're referring to Schedule 38?
Schedule 38, the more recent prices that we've been putting on.
Couple of other subjects, Mr. Duval. Can you help us by sort of giving us an update on where the company stands with regard to the solar integration study? Do you have an idea of when the commission might see that?
Well, the sequencing that the folks are working on this is that they put the capacity factor study. There were two studies that the commission asked.
I wanted to ask you about the other one as well. So if you just want to update us on all of them, that's great.
Okay. So on the capacity factor study, the study, technical study, has been complete. It was completed in August. It's being reviewed. Testimony is being prepared. And I would hope that maybe by the end of this month or early next month, that will be filed with the commission.
And that would apply to both wind and solar?
Yes, it would. Yeah, I believe that's right. And then the solar integration study is further down the pike. At this point, we don't have actual solar data to help us put that study together. So at this point, I've asked the folks who are working on it, and I have not got a firm schedule at this point.
Those are all my questions. Any follow-up, Mr. Solander?
No, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Follow-up. Absolutely.
Thank you. Just as a follow-up to your answer to Commissioner Clark's question.
And you don't have to ask me, Commissioner LaVar.
What?
You asked me if you could follow up. I said, you don't have to ask me.
Okay, just so you would know what I was doing, though.
Absolutely.
Your answer to Commissioner Clark on the Schedule 38 pricing on the four completed dockets versus the ones that are in process. And again, if I'm asking a question that approaches on the confidential areas and the ongoing dockets, please say so. But is the biggest, all of those, the ones that Mr. Vasteg calculated and the ones in process, are all under the new order, the 12035-100 docket.
Correct.
Is the difference in pricing between those the difference in what's being displaced, or is there something else that's driving the difference between 5 to 6 and generally 3 to 4?
No, it's in the amount of QF requests we've got in the queue. And as you get more and more QF requests, you go lower down on the stack in terms of what's displaceable next.
Thank you. You're excused, Mr. Ball.
Thank you.
Anything further, Mr. Solon? Is your direct case?
That's my direct case, thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Jenner.
Thank you. The division would like to swear in and call our first witness, Dr. Abdul Nasser Abdullah.
You solemnly swear that the testimony you're about to give should be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth.
I do.
Thank you, Dr. Abdullah. Please be seated. Jenner, whenever you're ready.
Thank you. Dr. Abdullah, would you please state your name and occupation for the record, and would you please spell your name also for the court reporter?
My name is Abdul Nasir Abdullah. The first name Abdul Nasir, A-B-D-I-N-A-S-I-R, Abdullah, A-B-D-U-L-L-E. And I'm a technical consultant for the Division of Public Utilities.
Thank you. And did you prepare and file direct and rebuttal testimony in this docket?
Yes, I did.
Do you have any changes or updates that you'd like to make to either of those pre-filed testimonies?
No changes.
And if you were asked the same questions that were included in both of those filings today, would your answers remain the same?
Yes.
Thank you. Have you prepared a brief statement summarizing the position of the Division of Public Utilities?
Yes, I did.
Please go ahead.
I filed a direct rebuttal testimonies in this proceeding. In those, I addressed the proposed change that the company filed. Those changes were the ones that were just recently released down by Mr. Duval. But to refresh it, it is including the integration and capacity costs for wind and solar qualifying facilities in avoided cost calculations for Schedule 37. Removing capacity costs of simple cycle conversion turbine from the calculation of avoided costs for Schedule 37 during the sufficiency period. Removing from the official forward price curve a specific area that represents future carbon dioxide tax. Eliminating the capacity and energy payment options related to the monthly payments. And also keeping the seasonal depreciated on peak and off peak energy prices, but providing these prices, pricing schemes for a base load facility, wind facility, and a solar facility separately. In addition to those that I just listed, changes, there were other routine changes that the company usually do it on a yearly basis that were made. The division reviewed these proposed changes and concluded that with the exception of removing the carbon dioxide tax item from the official forward price curve, that these changes are just reasonable and in the public interest, and recommend is that the commission approve it. Regarding the carbon dioxide tax adder, the division found that the commission direction in docket 1503500 was ambiguous and could not make a decision, therefore did not take a position on that issue. Thank you. That concludes my summary.
Thank you. The division would like to move at this time for entry of the direct and rebuttal testimony of Dr. Abdullah into the record.
Any objections? They're received.
Thank you. I have just one quick follow-up question. I believe you said 1305100, and I think the docket number maybe, is it possible it's 1203-5100?
That's correct.
Thank you. I have no further direct questions, and our witness is available for cross. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Jenner. Mr. Olson.
We have no cross. Thank
you. No questions. Thank you.
Oh, thanks, Mr. Solander. Sorry to jump over you.
Thank you, Commissioner Clark. Good morning, Dr. Abdullah. In your direct testimony at line 58,
I got it.
Oh, thank you. You say the
Vision believes that with the exception of some simplifications that are already in place, all QF should be treated equally, and their avoided cost should be calculated the same way regardless of their sizes. Could you tell me what are those simplifications already in place?
In different hearing schedule 37 from schedule 38, given the fact that the schedule 37 customers are small, those simplifications are those that were designed to remove the burden, administrative burden from schedule 37 customers.
So would you agree that the size of the resource model in the grid run is one of those simplifications?
That's the differentiation between the two schedules is the size.
And also the supply curve of the resource model in grid?
I'm not sure what that means.
I'll make it clearer. I'm sorry. I'll get to that. Can I lead you to your rebuttal testimony at line 42? You say capacity payments during the sufficiency period when an FOT is displaced, which includes a capacity payment, would overcompensate the QF contrary to the ratepayer indifference standard. Is that correct?
Correct.
I'd like to ask you some questions about how energy payments in the resource sufficiency period are calculated under Schedules 37 and 38 and how they're different.
Yeah.
So under Schedule 38, avoided energy costs in the sufficiency period are calculated on differential grid runs, and the QF resource is modeled with a supply curve based on its actual supply characteristics. Is that correct?
I'm not sure what that's asking, but the way I presented it and the intent I had about this statement is the fact that running the grid when the QF is displacing a point of transaction, that the grid model captures the whole avoided cost, which also includes these competitive costs that were there. So adding it again would overcompensate.
Sure, but I just want to ask you some questions about how Schedule 37 and Schedule 38 differ. So in Schedule 38, the proxy resource, if you will, although I may be conflating my methods, the resource modeled to calculate energy payments in the sufficiency period is based on the QF that has approached the company. So for example, if I'm a solar QF developer and I'm approaching Rocky Mountain Power for a Schedule 38 contract, in order to figure out avoided cost energy prices in the sufficiency period, the company will model a grid run with the supply curve that corresponds with the type of resource I'm proposing, size and supply curve. Is that correct?
Correct.
And and as you were saying, the commission has found that to the extent the QF supply curve displaces front office transactions in that grid run, the avoided costs compensate for avoided capacity costs as a component of the avoided front office transactions. Is that correct?
Correct.
So under Schedule 37, energy costs in the sufficiency period are based on the addition of a zero cost 10 average megawatt resource. Is that correct?
Correct.
And that resource is added as a flat decrement to load, correct?
Correct.
So the energy price based on this flat decrement to load is an average energy price that does not take into consideration the supply characteristics of unique QF resources or the resources that an actual QF would displace. Is that correct?
It does not include the unique characteristics of the QF.
So it's possible, isn't it, that the Schedule 37 energy price does not offset summertime front office transaction capacity to the same extent that a solar QF's actual supply curve would offset summertime front office transaction capacity. Is that correct?
I don't agree with that. When you display the front office transaction, regardless of the size of the what buying basket that's offsetting, the grid model will calculate what the avoided cost is or should be. And that's the number that would be the number we would use as avoided cost, and that includes capacity cost of using.
But do you agree that an actual solar supply curve may displace more front office transactions than a flat decrement to load?
A comparison between flat decrement load and a solar
supply curve, which produces most of its energy in the summertime?
Yes.
So, a QF that produces most of its energy in, for example, third quarter heavy load hours would not get compensated or would displace more front office transactions than a 10 megawatt flat load decrement. I think that's what I just asked, sorry. And so to the extent that an actual solar QF produces most of its energy in those heavy load hours, it does not get compensated to the same extent under Schedule 37 as an actual solar supply curve would get compensated for under Schedule 38. Is that correct?
There are so many different small QFs that are out there, solar, wind, whatever you call it. And each one, if you go on and you use the specific characteristics of those things and you negotiate prices at Schedule 38, would be that would put a lot of burden to these small QFs. So these changes, these differences we're talking about now, are the reason that, are the difference between the two. And those, that specific QF, small QF, would be different than the other one, and would be different than the other one. They are all different, so that's why we're proposing the price to avoid all those problems.
Right, so would you agree that by simplifying the method, Schedule 37 QFs are not compensated in the same way or to the same extent, for example, under Schedule 38, which models the actual supply curve?
Yes.
So, if simplifications to Schedule 37 prices have the effect of artificially reducing 37 prices compared to Schedule 38 prices, do Schedule 37 prices discriminate against small QFs relative to large QFs?
I don't think so. The simplification is our cost saving for these small QFs. It's not cost burden on them. So they're not going to be undercompensated based on the calculations that are put there in the grid model and the calculations on avoided costs. I don't think that they are under.
Even though they're compensated less for example, their energy and capacity based on the way energy prices are calculated?
The fact that we're proposing a price that that would be applicable to all small QFs is not, that price that we're proposing may not be the same if we had to calculate each one of them individually.
I have no further questions. Thank you.
Mr. Dodge.
Thank you. Dr. Adu, good morning. The division, in your testimony, you reference the importance of the ratepayer indifference standard, right?
Yes.
The division recognizes, does it not, that another goal of PURPA and Utah's many PURPA statutes are to encourage the development of small, clean, renewable projects.
Correct.
if you stated several times that some of the proposals being made by Utah Clean Energy you oppose on the grounds that it would violate the ratepayer indifference standard. Does the division give equal consideration to whether the approach the company uses in setting avoided cost rates may undervalue the avoided cost pricing?
And some of the question as you saying, like, we consider the fact that the price that they're posting may be 100.
Yes, and is that an issue that you would be concerned about?
Yes.
And I guess, has the division had any discussions about their level of confidence in a 20-year levelized 3 to 4 cent energy plus capacity future? If that's the prices that the current avoided costs are spitting out for Schedule 37, and we heard today for Schedule 38 projects, does the division have confidence that the 20-year levelized cost of resources, energy plus capacity is going to be in the $30 to $40 per megawatt range, megawatt hour range?
The division did not have a specific discussion on that specific question in this proceeding.
As a doctor of economics and a utility specialist, what level of confidence do you have that that will be the pricing we'll see over the next 20 years?
Over 20 years, I cannot say my confidence level is 100%, but I cannot. I forward to calculate what that specific number would be percentage number, but we are confident that to a certain extent that it would be true.
And you do accept that ratepayers are not indifferent and are in fact damaged if avoided cost rates are set too low and it makes projects that would otherwise be built not be built. Do you have projects?
Yes.
Thank you. No further questions.
Redirect.
No redirect. Thank you.
Questions from the commission? Dr. Abdullah, you're excused. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Anything further, Mr. Jenner?
No, thank you. That concludes the division's presentation.
Jules?
At this time, we'd like to call Doug Aspen.
Do you solemnly swear the testimony you're about to give should be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
Yes, I do.
Thank you very much. Please be seated.
Could you please state your name, please, and your position.
My name is Bela Bostock. That's B-E-L-A. Last name Bostock, B-A-S-T-A-G. I'm a utility analyst employed by the Office of Consumer Services, and my business address is here in this building, 160 East, 300 South, Salt Lake City.
On August 12, 2014, you provide conditional testimony in this proceeding?
Yes.
And on August 29, 2014, did you provide rebuttal testimony?
Yes.
At this time, do you have any changes to make in your testimony?
No changes.
So if you were asked those questions again, your answers would remain the same?
Yes.
Have you prepared a summary of your testimony?
Yes, I have.
Would you please read that for the record?
In my testimony, I provided the Office of Consumer Services position on the company's proposed Schedule 37, changes to Schedule 37, which I will summarize. The office recommends that the commission approve the company's proposed changes. The office supports the changes because they will reestablish ratepayer indifference for pricing under Schedule 37, and they will implement commission-approved guidelines for QF avoided cost pricing from docket 12-035-100. The current Schedule 37 pricing format that includes a capacity payment can provide QS compensation that greatly exceeds the company's avoided cost. This violates the purpose standard of ratepayer difference. In addition, the current two pricing formats under Schedule 37 provide substantially different payments to QF. Again, this violates the purpose standard of ratepayer indifference. Therefore, the office supports the company's proposal to eliminate the pricing format that includes a capacity payment and only provide QF payments in an energy-based format or on a per kilowatt hour basis. This payment format is also consistent with how large QFs are paid under Schedule 38. The company's proposed changes also implement certain provisions for QF avoided cost methods, which were ordered by the Commission in Docket 12035-100 for large QFs under Schedule 38. These provisions include, one, integration charges for wind and solar QFs, two, capacity contribution values for wind and solar QFs, three, no additional capacity payments are to be given to QFs during this efficiency period, four, no specific adjustments to QF pricing are to be made for the value of fuel price hedging, fuel price volatility, or environmental risk. The company has complied with these four provisions in their proposed Schedule 37 pricing by implementing integration charges and capacity values for wind and solar QFs, by removing capacity payments based on a simple cycle combustion turbine during this efficiency period, and by removing the effect of a hypothetical CO2 tax from the forecast of wholesale electricity prices. The office asserts that these changes proposed by the company are appropriate because the method for calculating QF avoided cost pricing should be consistently applied, whether for large QFs under Schedule 38 or for small QFs under Schedule 37. The office understands that in order to provide small QFs a streamlined contracting process under Schedule 37, the avoided cost modeling needs to be somewhat simplified and cannot be exactly the same as in Schedule 38. However, the provisions ordered by the Commission in docket number 12035-100 should be applied to all QFs. The office also understands that even when the methods for calculating avoided cost pricing are applied consistently, prices will be different for different QFs, because pricing is also dependent on such factors as when the modeling is done, which IRP preferred portfolio is used, where the QF is in the queue, etc. Some parties in this proceeding claim that the modeling of Schedule 37 pricing needs to be consistent with certain assumptions from the company's IRP. Some claim that assumptions should be the same as the IRP base case. It is unclear what the IRP base case is. The office does not believe that PURPA requires QF avoided costs be consistent with the utility's IRP, but that they should be reflective of actual costs that the company will avoid. Even if some type of consistency with the IRP was mandated, this would be difficult to achieve since each IRP models multiple cases with widely varying assumptions. The cases and assumptions modeled change each IRP cycle. On the other hand, the IRP and QF avoided cost pricing are prominently linked because the IRP's preferred portfolio is used in the modeling of QF prices. In addition to supporting the company's proposed changes, my testimony also provided two additional recommendations of the office. These recommendations are, one, the company should work with stakeholders and regulators concerning any QF-related transmission constraints and make a filing with the Commission before implementing any change to avoid cost pricing for transmission constraints. And number two, in future annual Schedule 37 filings, the company should include a list of projects that have contracted with the company under Schedule 37 during the previous year. And this list should include some specific information about each project. That
concludes my summary.
Anything further?
No, Your Honor, Mr. Patrick is now available for cross-examination.
And you'd like us to receive in evidence his direct and rebuttal testimony?
Yeah, I didn't know exactly when you wanted me to ask that, but I would, Your Honor.
It's fine, sir.
Thank you.
So, now, is there any objection? That's received. Thank you. Cross-examination?
No questions, thank you. No questions from the division.
Thank you, Commissioner Clark. Good morning, Mr. Rostov.
Good morning, Ms. Hayes.
Can I direct you to your rebuttal testimony at page 8, starting at line 151?
Okay.
You say, even if the capacity payment format could be modified to produce the same total payments as the energy-only format for the proposed rates in this proceeding, the likelihood is that they will deviate again in the future. It would be administratively burdensome to continually review these rates to ensure they remain in sync. Is that correct?
Yes.
Are you aware that the Commission requires that the company review its Schedule 37 prices once a year or whenever the 25 megawatt cap is reached?
Yes.
Are you aware that the Commission requires the company to file updates to its Schedule 38 pricing input assumptions 4 times a year?
I believe it's 4 times.
Are you aware that Schedule 38 pricing, which is unique to specific QFs, changes with every QF based on the QF's resource type and size and the resources it displaces?
Right, for every QF, the pricing is different.
So you are aware then that Schedule 38 prices are not fixed at a specific rate. Is that correct?
That's correct.
There's no platonic ideal avoided cost.
Unfortunately.
Yeah, right. And Schedule 38 prices and terms are negotiated based on a commission-approved method, is that correct?
Yes.
Whereas Schedule 37 prices are not based on a specific QF resource, but are rather based on a flat 10 megawatt load decrement, is that correct?
I'm not exactly sure what you mean by flat 10 megawatt load decrement, but I'll... Except that.
Okay.
That if you
it's
say that that's what happened, what it is.
Okay. So it would not make sense to reset Schedule 37 rates every time a new Schedule 38 PPA is signed or removed from the queue, would it?
No.
Based on administrative efficiency, for example.
Right. One of the purposes of Schedule 37 is to provide a simple process for QF contract with the company.
So you recognize that there will always be some inconsistency between Schedule 37 and Schedule 38 pricing, correct?
Yes.
If you could continue looking at your testimony, starting where I left off at 155. Therefore, the office asserts that there should be just one payment format for Schedule 37, incorporating the company's avoided cost. And for simplicity and consistency with Schedule 38, that payment format should be an energy-only format?
Yes.
Why is it important that the single payment option for Schedule 37 be an energy-only payment?
Well, in order to, the first part of the reasoning is that there shouldn't be two different payment formats for Schedule 37 because they, as we've seen in the current schedule, they produce different prices. So if we need to choose one of them, then one reason to choose the energy only is that that's the way Schedule 38 projects are paid. So it would be using the similar pricing format between the two schedules.
But you mentioned and you recognized previously that it would be possible to set both payment options so they were consistent, correct?
Anything's possible, yeah. I mean, novel things at the beginning.
Anything is possible, what a positive statement for the day. And we've already established that Schedule 38 pricing is a moving target, correct?
Yes, it changes with each PPA.
And that Schedule 37 and 38 prices may coincide, but will never likely be exactly the same, correct?
knows by definition of the way the modeling works, they won't be exactly the same unless we get lucky.
Thank you. I have no further questions.
Mr. Dodge.
Good morning, Mr. Dodge.
Good morning.
I'm looking at your rebuttal testimony beginning on line 53. This is dealing with CO2 taxes, and you indicate the position of the office is based on the plain language from the commission's order in the Schedule 38 QF docket that, quote, we approve no specific adjustments to value fuel price hedging, fuel price volatility, or environmental risk. Is it the office, or is it your view that the plain language of that order said that the company was in fact instructed to make four specific adjustments to its normal grid modeling to remove the impacts of the projected CO2 costs?
Excuse me, did you say four adjustments?
Will you accept subject to check that in fact the company made adjustments to four of the, what's the right word, grid files? There are four grid files normally used for grid purposes, including QS, that included some impact from CO2 cost assumptions.
Can you explain what are those grid files, what data do they contain?
You and I are both in a handicap because I suspect you don't run grid and neither do
I. No, I haven't.
But I'll tell you what I understand, and I'll just ask you, subject to check, then I'll ask my question. I'm not asking you to verify this, but it's my understanding that carbon costs were adjusted out of the grid file called energy charge, adjusted out of the grid file called fuel price, adjusted out of the grid file called other costs, and adjusted out of the grid file called price forecast. In other words, there are four specific input files to grid to which specific adjustments were made to remove the impacts of CO2 costs, as I understand. Now, without asking you to verify, if you accept that, subject to check,
okay,
is it your view that the plain language of the 12035-100 order was that the company should make specific adjustments to those four files to remove the impacts of projected carbon costs?
Well, the order didn't direct the company to make any specific adjustments to any specific files. It said that avoided cost would not have a specific adjustment for environmental costs. So how that's implemented is within the grid modeling is beyond my expertise, and I would have to rely on the company's expertise.
But when you say you rely on the plain language of the order, that suggests to me that you think that order plainly said, notwithstanding saying make no specific adjustments, that in fact what it means is go make specific adjustments to four files to remove your projected impacts of carbon costs. Is that how you read the plain language?
Well, the company in its current modeling at the time of Schedule 37 had included a CO2 cost, which apparently is opposite of what the commission ordered in Docket 12035-100. So they had to make adjustments to the modeling to adjust for that requirement.
You say it was contrary to it. Did the company adjust its Schedule 38 pricing immediately following the entry of the 12035-100 order, to your understanding?
At some point, they adjusted their Schedule 38 pricing. I'm not sure when that was implemented.
The office has seen a number of QF projects come before the commission for approval in the last year, correct?
Correct.
And those were done, some of them before and some of them after the 12035-100 order came out in, I believe it was August, was it, or September of 2013?
It was August, yeah.
Some of those contracts were done after that, is that not right?
Yes.
And is it your understanding, or do you agree that the company did not remove the CO2 taxes immediately after the 12035-100 order, that in fact those QF projects that have come forward for approval included the CO2 assumptions, and it was only this year, a year later almost, when they were redoing 37 prices, and then they began in 38 to remove them. Is that your understanding?
Well, I understand from informal discussions with the company that there was some lag between this 03-100 order, 03-5-100 order, and when they implemented the order provisions. And I'm not sure the timing as to which of the QFPPAs incorporated the new requirements, but I understand there was some lag. What did not occur immediately?
So if it was the plain language of the commission's order, the company just violated that order until it finally implemented that this year. Is that kind of your view?
Well, violate is I'm not sure if I agree with that word, but you have to give the company some leeway in implementing. I don't.
Even if it's the plain language, I guess that's what I'm chafing at. You say plain language, and I have a really hard time with your view. The plain language of that order said remove these CO2, make these CO2 adjustments, when the company itself didn't make them for months, and you didn't propose that they make them. The office, right?
No.
Until they came forward.
Right. We were not aware of those specific adders, the way they work in the QF model.
Mr. Vostok, you're here representing an entity that represents consumers, electric consumers. It's a role I'm fairly comfortable with myself. I'd like to ask you a few questions from the perspective, your perspective of protecting customers. If QF pricing is set so low, artificially low, below what the actual cost of the company is going to be in the next 20 years to acquire resources, is the rate payer a different standard met or violated?
QF avoided cost isn't based on actual market costs. They're based on the cost that the company will avoid. And when, as we discussed earlier, that will, for a particular QF, their avoided cost will depend on where they are in the queue. As these projects stack up, the company's avoided cost decline. So when you talked earlier about this 3 or 4 cents actual fair market value, it's not really about fair market value, it's what the company avoids in the future.
Exactly. And if, in fact, pricing today is being set at 3 to 4 cents, and therefore projects that would otherwise be renewable projects that mitigate price risk for 20 years because it's a set price, that mitigate carbon risk because there's no carbon implications, etc. If those projects are not built, because 3 to 4 cents is lower than a reasonable projection of what they will actually spend, are ratepayers harmed?
No, because there's already many projects in the company's queue in the IRP resource plan that account for all those risks and all those costs, and these additional projects are not required to serve the customers.
Well, let's talk about that. Have you looked at the QFQ? Have you seen that in the Schedule 38 filing? And if you watch that over the years?
I've seen the transmission queue, which is on the company's transmission page.
I'm not talking the transmission queue, I'm talking the QFQ that the company files with its quarterly Schedule 38 update.
Yeah, I've glanced at that. I recall seeing that, yes.
Can you name one QF project that's been built in the state that is on that queue in the last 3 years?
I'm not sure. I don't know what that can mean.
So you're saying the customers are not harmed because let's say there's a queue of 15 resources. First of all, do you understand that to get on the queue, all you need to do is ask for indicative pricing?
I believe that's correct.
So if 15 QFs come in and say, give us indicative pricing, and if the pricing goes from 4 cents or 5 cents down to 3 cents by the end of the queue, and if none of those projects get built because they're the price too low, and then if the actual costs end up higher than what those projections were, are ratepayers not worse off?
Well, we don't know how the future will play out.
I understand.
My
assumption.
There is a version of the future where that could happen. Yes.
Well,
and again, another version where some of those QFs would be built, but we have to. The company does have to follow a process, and this is an issue that we've discussed in some of the PPA dockets where the number of projects in the queue and potentially QFs that aren't far enough along in development, even with the queue, they are harming other QFs who are more serious. So
well, I'm just asking,
an issue.
I'm just asking, does the office care if QF projects are not built? Is it the office preference just to kind of go with whatever the company decides to build and acquire and take those risks, as opposed to setting prices today that are known and that avoid carbon type risks and environmental risks, if the pricing is set the same and so that the rate is really indifferent? Would you not choose the renewable projects that add those other benefits?
Yeah, we care about those issues, yes.
And has the office looked to confirm to itself that the avoided cost pricing coming out of these models is a realistic projection of what the company would actually avoid or will actually incur if we go through this 20 years without these QF projects?
We're not in a position to dig that deeply in the model.
Thank you. No further questions.
Redirect, Mr. Olson. Mr. Bostock, you're excused. Thank you very much. We're contemplating a recess and wondering how much is in front of us, because we don't want to unnecessarily detain you.
Just one witness.
Utah Clean Energy will call Sarah Wright, but I think my witness and I would love a 5-minute break.
We'll be in recess until 25 minutes till the hour, so it'll be 10 minutes.